Welcome to our first ever NALP Next session. I'm Mary Beal, and I'm so happy to welcome all of you to this innovative session developed by our brilliant president, Mina Jefferson, who's in the audience with us. This is her brainchild, and we submitted, we had a proposal process for this. We received numerous submissions, but the four presenters to my right were the winners, and now we are so excited to hear from each of them. So we will hear one NALP Next talk, and then we'll take a minute to switch the mic, and then we'll hear the next one. So you may appreciate them in between as you wish. So we're so happy you're here. So why don't we get started? Donna Gerson is going to kick things off today, and she is going to be telling us what I learned from opening a cafe. And if you're just coming in, please come forward. They can't call on you because that's not what a NALP Next talk is. So you can sit right up here.
Thank you. Here we go. Good afternoon. My name is Donna Gerson, and I'm the Associate Dean at Drexel University Thomas R. Klein School of Law in Philadelphia. And I'm here to talk to you about what I learned from opening a cafe in my career services office. So I want to start by telling you a little bit about Drexel University. Drexel is a 125-year-old university. Our law school is 10 years old. And it has been started by the most enterprising group of faculty and staff. We're premised on the co-op model of education, much like Northeastern University. So all of our students have experience working with employers all around the world, and they're practice-ready lawyers as a result, and we're really proud of that. Now, my journey to this point began many, many years ago. I have been in career services and around law students and working with law schools for the better part of 20 years now. So I've really earned the experienced professional section luncheon now, finally. And what informs me, what allows me to do this work and do it so joyously, is that I truly believe that we have to connect students to opportunities. Somebody once asked Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, what was the secret to happiness? And her answer was a brilliant three-word answer. It's work worth doing, right? And it really reflects on my values and my strengths and interests, because what I want to do is work worth doing, and what I want my students to do is work worth doing. Work is at the heart of everything that gives meaning to our lives. It is an important part of who we are. It's our livelihood, but for many of us, it's also our identity, and it's our self-esteem. When you see a law student come into your office who's looking for a job and they're confused and lost and stuck, their body and their affect looks depressed and sad. And it's like a world of difference when someone comes into your office and says, I have a job offer, and I know where I'm going next. And that work worth doing is what motivates and informs everything that I do. So how did I get to open a cafe? Well, this is sort of part of the journey of how I came to work worth doing. And it goes all the way back to 1988, when I started law school. So law school was very different in 1988. And for all my millennials here, I want to assure you, there were no personal computers. There were no iPhones. Computers, you know, Lexus were these standalone little terminals with little red chiclet keys. And career services was an evolving industry at this point. And so my career services office, which I know is trying very hard, it was a room full of black binders. So I call it the terror of the black binders. You would walk into this room, there was an office, there was someone sitting there. I was way too proud and way too frightened to go in and engage with this adult and talk to them about what was in those binders. But they had very strange names. They had things like public interest. What is this? I don't know. Government, law firms. And, you know, this was back in the day where you photocopied and threw three-hole punch things and stuck them in these binders, and people were poring over them. And I didn't know what the hell I was doing. Now, things turned out all right in the long run, but it was a bumpy road a little bit for me. But I said to myself, I would love to find a way to connect people to the workplace that didn't consist of the terror of the black binder, where someone is standing helplessly in an office saying, I don't even understand what is going on here. So, next step, I think this is 1994. Here's where I'm the assistant director at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. My hair's almost the same, I think. And this is where I really started to engage with students and go on this journey. My first NALC conference was in 1994 in Orlando, Florida. That's how long I've been in and around this. It was here that I really began to develop my skills and to write for the NALC Bulletin, to write for the ABA, to start writing books and guidebooks, including Choosing Small. But the best part is I get to fast forward to 2014 when I started at Drexel University, Thomas R. Klein School of Law. And that's me with my wonderful staff, including Amy Weiss, who's here as well. And this was a place where I have been able to institute all of these plans and ideas that I've collected over the years, from my visits to law schools, from speaking with colleagues, and really put them into action in a very real way. So this is just the mission statement that informs everything that we do in our office. And the punchline to this is that we're here to foster a values-driven job search. Remember, work worth doing. And one of the ways that we can do this is by connecting with students exactly where they are. I think of my millennial students, God love them, as scared woodland creatures, like I was myself. You need to lure them out of the forest line and bring them into your office, right? I can only plan so many programs, as you all probably struggle with, right? You can do programs after programs, and they might work, they might not work. But what really works, I've learned, is working with students one-on-one and meeting them exactly where they are, which brings me to my cafe. So this is a picture of the cafe. It's an old version. I have a newer, cooler, bigger Keurig now. And it kind of started by accident. So when I showed up in 2014, there was, in fact, a Keurig in the office, and I was told that there were many rules around this Keurig, that my predecessor had said that we could have that first years could have coffee on Mondays, and second years could have coffee on Tuesdays, and third years could have coffee on Wednesdays, I suppose. And there were key fobs, apparently, and there were a lot of rules. And one of my philosophies that I've put into practice is we must have low barriers to entry when we work with students. And that means that we don't have a lot of signage. We have as few rules as possible. When we explain rules to millennials, we give them our reasoning. So it's never like the Ten Commandments. It's the 10 strongly worded suggestions with an emoticon, you know, on it. And my CSO cafe, there are all these rules. And so in a great moment of magnanimity and stupidity, I said, you know what? There should be free coffee for everyone. I'm opening a cafe, and it's going to be awesome. And so it began. We started with this cafe, and what it did, very interestingly, was it drove a ton of traffic into our office. It started slowly. It was a trickle. And now when classes let out, you can almost time it by the watch. They're in your office, in the central foyer of the office. They're getting coffee, they're getting tea, they're getting spring water, they're getting hot cocoa. It's all free. What's amazing about this is there's a lot of people who can fit in the office, and we can engage with these students right where they are. And so it's a wonderful facet of the work that I can step out of my office when the coffee train arrives and just say, hey, how are you? What's doing? Ooh, looks like a lot of people out here today. Just they see me. I see them, and they see me, and they see my door open. And they come by and ask questions. They stop in my doorway and say, I have a quick question for you. And you have a chance to engage with them on their terms in their time. And it's turned out to be part of my larger warm and welcoming environment for law students because I find this is what works. So some other ways that we've created a warm and welcoming environment are... I sometimes bring in scented candles, and the students really like it. In winter, we have pine, and springtime, we have lemon. It's probably a fire hazard. There's been one time when I have had to return to the office after hours because you get home and go, I blew out the candle, didn't I? No, I didn't, did I? I'll bring flowers in from Trader Joe's, cheap, inexpensive flowers. I like to bake, but I have no one to bake for anymore because I'm an empty nester, and so my students are the beneficiaries of cookies, candy, whatever's in my house from time to time. This is not, you know, we have a strong open door policy in our office, which is both a win and a lose for us sometimes because we're interrupted a lot, but we find that having the door open is very, very important to having students engage with us on their own terms. We also keep the place clean and orderly, and this means that I have bought a vacuum because, number one, students open sugar packets like wild animals opening things, but also because we have employers coming, and sometimes our cleaning staff isn't as fast as I'd like them to be. I find that where people are feeling chaotic and disordered and upset, a room that is orderly and clean really, really helps. I'm also a very type A personality, if you have not noticed. We strive for an office that is accessible and transparent. We use simplicity all the time for all of our postings. And we operate in a strict no judgment, no freak out zone. I say this all the time. You will never be judged. I will never ask you your grades unless it is absolutely relevant to the conversation. I will not be here to scold you at any time. I spent a lot of time when I started taking down signs around my office that had a lot of instructions that my predecessor had set up because I want people to feel there are as few rules as possible to allow them to focus on what's important. And finally, I hire committed staff who are happy to help, and I'm so proud of all of the work that they have done. That includes you, Amy. So, what have I learned from opening this cafe? I've learned a couple of things. One is, it costs a lot of money. But it is money that is very, very well spent, in my opinion. It's money that I'm willing to set aside because it brings in my students. I learned that coffee buys a lot of goodwill from students. When you feed them and when you nourish them and show them that you care, you buy their goodwill. And I can tell you that some of the concrete results that I have seen have been, number one, I'm proud to say I have strong employment numbers for a school of my ranking and my size and my location. I'm deeply proud of what my students have accomplished. I'm also proud to say that for the last 2 years, I have had zero unknowns on my ABA employment survey. And I attribute some of that to the fact that it's really hard to ignore someone who's fed you for 3 years and shown you only kindness. I may be proven wrong someday, but I'd like to think that the cafe has helped me. And finally, I have learned that students really, really like French vanilla coffee. And if you don't have the French vanilla, you might as well not open the career services office that day. So, in conclusion, I would ask you to try it yourself. A little coffee, a little conversation, and some connections could make somebody's life have a life-changing career experience and lead them to work worth doing. Thank you.
Okay, Donna Gerson, thank you so much. Those of you standing, there may be some chairs. There's one here for sure. So make yourselves at home. We're super excited because next up we're going to be hearing from the fabulous Rachel Bosch. Both Rachel and Donna are on their third presentation of the conference, so they are my heroes. Hi. Is it real high? Rachel's going to be telling us about the gig economy. So let me get in place, Rachel, and then...
You got it. Hi there. As Mary said, my name is Rachel Bosch. I have been in legal talent recruiting and development for the past 11 years, And I recently left my wonderful, wonderful law firm to launch my own business. So I am the newest member of the gig economy, and that is exactly what I'm here to talk to you guys about today. So I want to start with a question. Who in here has been told to do more with less in the last couple years? Raise of hands. Yeah. Second question. Who was overwhelmed when they heard that they were going to need to do more with less? Yeah. I also felt that way. The good news is that there is an entire segment of the economy that is out there and that can help you do this in a cost-effective way. So when I mentioned that I was talking about the gig economy, most of you probably thought about Uber, Airbnb, and Lyft. These are all things that are part of the shared economy. So the shared economy is when you find pockets of time in your life that are not currently being monetized, and you monetize them. So maybe you've got a car, and you're not doing anything on the weekend, so you drive some people back and forth to the airport. You're making some money. Or you've got a condo downtown and you're going to go on vacation, so you rent that out. You're making some money. You're not adding anything particularly new. You're just monetizing what's exactly there. What we're going to talk about today is the freelance economy, which is a separate part of the gig economy. It's also known as the agile workforce. And as of 2016 October, it accounted for 35% of the U.S. economy. That's a lot of people. To give you some context, we're here in San Francisco. I like baseball. You like baseball. AT&T Park, where the Giants play. If you filled AT&T Park every single day for 4 years running, that's how many people are in the freelance economy today. It's 55 million people. And what's crazy is that Pew has told us that by 2020, the number's going to double. So by 2020, what we're saying is that over half of the U.S. economy is going to be made up of freelancers, sole proprietors, and solopreneurs. So imagine how that's going to shape the economy. Now, I want to cover some misconceptions because people have some ideas about the gig economy. First of all, I hear a lot of, well, people were forced into that. They lost their job or they had encountered a layoff. They had nothing else to do, so they just had to do something. 63% of people in the freelance economy are like me, and they actively chose to leave a job that they probably loved like I did to do something else. And what's interesting is that over half of them reported that they made more money in their first year out on their own than they did when they were with their employer. And all of them reported greater satisfaction, greater flexibility, and the ability to focus on the work that they want to do. In our plenary, we heard that 30% of employees are actually engaged in their work. I think it's interesting that 35% of employees in the market are freelancers. I wonder how much of that overlaps. So, you're thinking to yourself right now, this is great, but how is this going to help me do more with less and feel less overwhelmed, right? Well, I hear a lot of people who tell me that law firms are just not that creative, they're not that innovative, they maybe won't do the latest, coolest thing. I want you to think back to our office spaces and what they looked like 5 years ago. In cities across this country, of law firms of every size and demographic, our law firm spaces have changed dramatically. We've got these beautiful glass walls and collaboration spaces, right? We take up a much smaller footprint because we want to bring people together. And there are so many people who will tell you that the reason we're doing that is to appeal to the lovely millennials that we serve. And there may be some truth to that, but Gensler, who is the number one architect of a lot of these new spaces, has even called it out and said, look, real estate is the number two overhead for law firms. They need to reduce their costs. They changed their footprint, reduced their real estate cost, and they did it in a creative and innovative way. So this got me thinking. Okay, if law firms are willing to be creative and innovative with their space, which quite frankly we all know is something that they hold near and dear to their heart, why wouldn't they do that with their number one overhead expense? And do you know what their number one overhead expense is?
Comp.
Payroll. Labor. So right now you might be freaking out on the inside, and don't worry, I am not saying that you're all going to lose your jobs. What I am saying is that law firms have a unique opportunity to take advantage of efficient solutions that have been presented to them by this disruption in our economy. they can add specialists to their lineup that can complement the talent management teams that you work in and help you respond to the increasingly specialized demands of your attorneys. Some of you may already be doing this, but if you're not, I want you to think about one of your associates who's doing pretty well, right? But they're just not a great writer. What if you could bring in somebody who was a writing expert to work with them, and then they could totally succeed? Imagine then they make partner because you were able to do that for them. Or, and this is happening a lot right now, think about if your management team came to you and said, all right, we want to totally just redo performance. It's just not working for us. We want to redo it. What if you could call on a consultant who just worked in performance management? They are going to know the latest trends. They are going to know the best practices. And the product you give back to your management team is going to be so much better because you were able to bring that person in. What if you were able to have some coaches on hand who could work with your attorneys and give them the critical skills and invest that time to help them become accountable and achieve their goals? When I was in a law firm, that's something that I really wanted to do a lot of. And quite frankly, I was just stretched too thin. I didn't have the time to meet with people and to work on that with them. We know that law firms don't like to spend extra money, right? I want you to think about this. If you take a full-time equivalent employee, and then you take a full-time freelancer, corporations report that they save 30% on the freelancer. And what are the odds that you're hiring a freelancer full-time for the entire year? You're not. You're really using them as spot treatment. In our talent management teams, we are running a series of different type of work products and projects that are this wide and this deep. But sometimes your attorneys really need a solution that is focused this wide and this deep. And that's when you bring in the freelancer. That's when you bring in the specialist. You may still be thinking, okay, I hear you, Rachel. It's going to save some money. It's going to be good, but like we're still not going to do it. Look around your law firm, because there are hints that your law firm is into this and that they might be willing to do it. You've got contract attorneys. They're all freelancers. You bring in a big new matter, you're probably going to have a project manager for that person. And they're not going to be full-time. They're just going to be there to handle that matter until it's done. I've seen more and more that our business development teams, when they bring on big events, when they're leading up to something that's really huge, they'll bring in somebody who specializes in getting that event ready and up and running and making sure that you have everything you need. So my question to you is, if your law firms are willing to do this for all these other departments, why shouldn't they help you guys out? So, talent management teams can really benefit and add a huge value to their firms by adding freelancers in to their lineup. In the end, you're going to do more with less, and you're going to be less overwhelmed. Thanks.
Thank you. That was awesome. We've got to get a battery going here on the phone. Oh, no. Continuing on.
Yeah. Do you have one?
Yes, yes. I'm good.
Okay, so Rachel, thank you so much. That was fantastic. All right, so next up we have Courtney Harris,
yes.
And she is going to be talking about...
First-generation professionals.
First-generation professionals. Thank you. I had to grab my battery.
That's okay. So picture this. There are three buckets in the front of the room, and I ask you to ball up a sheet of paper and toss that piece of paper in one of the buckets. If I told you that you would get $1 million if that piece of paper landed in one of those buckets, how many of you in the front row would be willing to change seats with somebody in the back row? Anybody? No? Okay. Why not? Because you know the people in the front row have a greater advantage when it comes to getting that piece of paper in that $1 million bucket, right? So let's talk about diversity for a minute. What we know is that the legal profession is not diverse. The American Bar Association has studied this number, and out of 1,315,000 attorneys, 36% are women, 5% are black, 4% are Hispanic, and 3% are Asian. Now, let me go back to that bucket analogy. Many law students who are the first in their family to attend law school feel very much like the people in the back of the room aiming for that million-dollar bucket, okay? So my question to you today is, do we add diversity to the definition of first-generation professional? Do we add that? So when I bring up this topic to people, I get a little bit of a blank stare, right? Probably for a lot of reasons. I don't know why, but one might be it's a mouthful, right? First-generation professionals. So we're going to shorten the definition today to FGP. Second, it is kind of a large concept to take in, right? So in 7 minutes, I can tell you right now, we are not going to decide whether or not the definition of diversity should be changed. I can guarantee you that. What I do want to ask you to do is think about how we can raise our emotional intelligence quotient when we think about differences, right? And these differences are based on things you can't help. They're based on your pre-adult circumstances. They're based on your upbringing. They're based on your family's life choices, okay? So, as I told you, I'm very into this topic, and I've decided to delve deeply into this topic. And one reason why I've decided to delve deeply into this topic is because I'm currently working at a three-year-old law school where most of our law students are the first in their family to attend law school, okay? So I talk to people about this, and inevitably I get the question. When I say I'm a first-generation professional, they ask me, when I talk about first-generation professional, they ask me, am I a first-generation professional? So I've started asking people when they ask me why they think I'm a first-generation professional, I say, why did you make that assumption that I'm a first-generation professional? And inevitably, we'll have that conversation. So when I was planning for this talk, I was talking to one of my coaches, and he kind of reminds me a little bit of Bill Nye, the science guy. Y'all know who that is? He kind of reminds me of him a little bit. So I'm telling him about my topic, and, you know, before I can even get it out, he says, were you a first-generation professional? And I said, why did you make that assumption? And he said, well, because I'm a first-generation professional, I thought we might have something in common. You see, he was focused more on our similarities than he was on our differences. So when we think about first-generation professionals, we have got to be able to dispel our assumptions. And dispelling assumptions is not a new concept. We have heard about this for years. It's called implicit bias, okay? But when we think about dispelling our assumptions with first-generation professionals, we want to think about three things, I think. The first thing is, remove that assumption about someone's educational lineage, okay? The second thing is, remove that assumption about somebody in general. And the third thing is, think about what we have in common. Okay, so I told you about this story, and I'm talking to people about being a first-generation professional, and some of you may have been thinking, you know, am I a first-generation professional? You may not have, I don't know. But I am not a first-generation professional. My mother has a PhD. She was in education administration for years. I don't know how many of you have parents who are in education administration. My father has an MBA. He's been a corporate executive for years. My paternal grandfather actually had two masters, one in math and one in education administration. He was an assistant superintendent, and I'm terrible at math, so I don't know what happened there. But I always kind of thought to myself, I wonder if education administration is kind of in my professional DNA, right? One of my first jobs when I was an attorney, I was in-house counsel for a school district, and then now I'm in law school administration, right? But what I do know is that as I went through my education, I was very into law school and undergrad, and I remember distinctly getting my first job when I graduated from law school, and I was very excited. Called my dad, and I said, guess what? You know, I got a job as an assistant attorney general. I'm going to be working for the state. And so my dad, in the true spirit of the corporate professional that he is, he first congratulated me, and his next question was, well, what's your salary? And so I told him, I said, it's $48,000. And without missing a beat, he said, oh, okay, so you're going to continue to look for another job, right? And so I told him, no. What I knew from talking to other attorneys and from talking to the folks in my career services office, is that that particular job with that salary, because it's not a high salary for a new attorney, that government job was the right job for me, okay? But here's the deal. My dad had only worked with corporate attorneys, right? So that was his point of reference. So I ask you, as we are thinking about first-generation professionals, let's also think about first-generation lawyers and first-generation leaders. Why first-generation leaders? Because lawyers tend to be leaders, bless you. Because lawyers tend to be leaders, right? Half of the C-suite officers at AT&T hold JD degrees. Half of the governors in our nation are attorneys. And I can guarantee you this, those folks did not get to where they are without the solid advice and counsel of a mentor, of a parent, or somebody in their life. So, when we think about how do we advise our first-generation professionals, we have to think about how we include them together. So right now, what you'll see in a lot of law schools is they're developing these programs, these affinity groups for first-generation professionals. As a matter of fact, yesterday I went to the seminar. It was fantastic, right? So as they're developing these first-generation affinity groups, we know that affinity groups tend to link people who have a common interest and purpose, right? But I believe that those people in those first-generation professional groups should be linked with a multi-generation professional as soon as possible. Why? Because they need that advice and counsel, right? So a real fundamental question that we're getting to is, we know that diversity revolves around race and gender, okay? So if we're going to change the definition of race and gender, we still need to look at the other number that's converse of the number that I spoke about before, okay? Remember, 88% of lawyers are white, and 64% of lawyers are male. And again, what we don't know in those numbers, or the numbers that I told you before, is how many people in those categories are first-generation professionals and first-generation lawyers. We have got to create an environment where we can nurture those first-generation professionals, and we've got to start to gather the data about who's a first-generation professional and mine that data, right? Now, you're probably saying, more data. I don't want to know about any more data. I've got to worry about employment data. Well, you already have to present that data to the ABA and NALC, right? But think about this and think about your students. Those students who are multi-generation professionals, think about those law students and how much easier it is for a law student to get a postgraduate job if someone in their family is a lawyer or if they've grown up around the legal profession. It's much easier. So this benefits you if you know how to advise your students who are first-generation professionals and give them the information they need. So I'm going to give you a little exercise when you leave here. NALC is almost over, and you've met some people since you've been. How many of y'all have met some new people since you've been here? Mm-hmm. Okay, good. So if you've met somebody who you feel like a little bit comfortable with and you feel like you can kind of have a conversation with them, ask them about their educational lineage. You will be surprised at the conversations that can start. And the other thing you might find out is how much sameness there can be in your differences. So if you think about that conversation you're having with somebody, when on the surface they may seem very much like you, but underneath they may be very different, it can help you to build a relationship with that person. So with that said, I want to leave you with a quote from John F. Kennedy. If we cannot now end our differences, at least we must help to make the world safe for diversity. Thank you.
Another home run. So last but not least today, we are going to hear from Christine McKinney. She's going to talk about cognitive diversity. She's going to first get her PowerPoint up, so let's just give her a minute, and then she'll be on.
So I was asked recently by my firm to define diversity and inclusion for our diversity strategic plan. So I sit down in my office and I begin to write my manifesto of what diversity looks like and what inclusion looks like. And I articulate that diversity is all of these differences that we bring to the table. And inclusion is the place where we bring them together so that we get the better business results that our clients talk about, that we know. Mary's videotaping this for some purpose, and I am completely mortified right now. Can we just stop that? We'll tell Jim we'll do it another time. Okay. Promise me no one's recording right now. Oh, God. Okay. I'm writing my manifesto, right? That's where we were. So, writing about diversity and inclusion, talking about our diversity is all of these things that make us different. We need an inclusive environment where we bring that together. We need to really focus on historically underrepresented groups that we've just heard are really still underrepresented in our profession. And I get a response back after I send this out that says something like, I get, Christine, that you believe diversity is this broad definition, but don't our surveys really just kind of ask for four things, and why should we actually care about anything else? And I thought for a long time about that perspective. And in one way, I agree with it. We do a lot of programming at our firms and our schools for visibly underrepresented individuals, and we need to do programming that brings up where we've had inequalities in the past, and we should have affinity groups, and we should have rich, rich programming. But I refer to the iceberg analogy, right? If there's so much diversity that falls under what we see. And if we're going to really advance the ball, my perspective is that we can't stop the conversation in talking about the things we report on the NELP form. So today, in that conversation, I want to present this idea of cognitive diversity, which reflects our differences in our mental processes, the way we think about things. And to be clear, those can be related to our gender, our race, our sexual orientation, our physical ability, our veteran status, all of those things that we count. But as we've heard, just because we might have those things in common doesn't mean that we're going to have other things under the iceberg in common, including cognitive diversity. And the reason I think this really, really matters is because our leaders today care deeply about diversity. I believe they are committed. But our leaders of tomorrow, in the spirit of NELP Next, if they can't figure out how to actively lead diverse teams, our industry is going to miss out. The global economy is here to stay. Our clients are around the world. And if our leaders don't have the tools to lead through a diverse team, they will not succeed. So that leads us to our brains. I don't pretend to be a huge expert. I have jotted on my notebook over there names of some serious scientists that you can go read. But I know enough to know that we have a left brain and a right brain, and that we have our cerebral mode, which tends to be our intellectual thought, and our limbic mode, which tends to be more of our emotional processing. I also know enough that we're hardwired to gravitate to perhaps more of an analytical perspective or more of an idea perspective. So this, again, is in the context of me working with my firm trying to talk about diversity and inclusion. And I get about this far, and I work in an IP firm, so they're scientists themselves, and I know I better just stop talking because this is about as far as my expertise goes, right? So then I'm on an airplane, and I have this in my bag. It's the March-April 2017 Harvard Business Review. And I pick it up, and it says, "The new science of teamwork, understanding how to meld different work styles will help you manage your team and yourself better." And I think, this is it. This is what I've been trying to articulate to our leadership. Yes, we have to continue to really focus on underrepresented groups, but that doesn't mean that we get to ignore the fact that we have other kinds of diversity in our organizations. So I start reading, and who better than Deloitte to launch a new product? This is their business chemistry, which I promise I'm not selling and I haven't even used. But in this context of the article, it really resonated with cognitive diversity in a way that I think we can start to talk about it. So I'm going to give you a quick overview of this product, again, based on my knowledge from a magazine article, and then talk about how I think we can use these tools in leading our teams. So similar to a lot of different assessments I'm sure you all have utilized, they've decided there are four types of people. Oh, I should say, they used a bunch of really smart scientists and have utilized this with, 190,000 people have taken the assessment, so it's clearly been statistically validated. I will say that. My grad school professors would be proud that I cared enough to look at the statistics. Oh, is that my timer?
No.
Okay. I can talk. No, you're good. So driver is somebody, think about, are you these people? And then the lawyers with whom you work, or the students, the leaders with whom you work. Driver likes logic systems and a laser focus on goals. A pioneer likes variety, possibilities, and generating new ideas. An integrator likes the personal connection and seeing how the pieces fit together. And the Guardian likes the concrete details. They really respect what is tried and true. Do you see how these kind of differentiate? So let's just say, for the sake of argument, that your recruiting team is a lot of integrators. You guys love the personal connections. You love seeing how the pieces fit together. So you build this wonderful team, and you get really excited about building relationships. And then you start to work with a hiring chair who maybe is more like a driver and is like, where are the quantitative goals? And you're like, uh-oh, we forgot about that. Because we're all these integrators. And so the concept is we have to begin to lead our teams. We're starting to think about these different perspectives in organizations. Uh-oh, I'm getting to that. Okay, so let's say you take my advice and you think, oh gosh, Christine's right. My team is full of tons of guardians. We love what's tried and true. We've done it the same way for a long time. I'm hiring for a new position. I'm really going to be mindful about getting someone who's going to bring a different kind of perspective to my team. So they show up, and then they start saying things like, why do you guys do it this way? And shouldn't we brainstorm about doing it that way? And all of a sudden, your really efficient team that are all the same kind of gets derailed because this one person is super annoying. They want you to think differently. And so then you're sitting in your team meetings, and you're like cursing that next lady because this person wants you to think differently. And I call that out because this is why we have to teach the tools. It's not easy. But it does help us deliver better results. So where should you start? You have to do this. You know it's the right thing to do. It might be kind of hard when you begin. And I believe you start by knowing yourself. I believe if you haven't taken any kind of assessment, and whether you use this Deloitte product or StrengthFinders or MBTI or a whole bunch of other ones, good ones that are out there, you need to come from a place of knowing who you are and what your cognitive styles are, how you like to work, how you like to lead. Then you need to know your team. You need to know the people with whom they work. And whether you have the resources to spend money on a deep assessment, or whether you pick up this HBR has like one of those pages where you can just check off what you like better and it kind of gives you an idea. The idea is you need to know your team, and then you really need to go further to get to know the people that are different than you are. And I would say in another context, if I'm not talking about cognitive diversity, this is true for all kinds of diversity. But in cognitive diversity, you need to understand how people that think differently than you think are coming at problems. You need to seek and listen to their viewpoints, the viewpoints that are different than yours. And I'll give you some examples on these if I have time. I'll go quickly. When you're in a team meeting, right, and I'm trying to launch this diversity strategic plan and a bunch of action items, I'm working with my diversity committee, and we all get it, right? We're the choir. We are singing in the same tune. And then we begin to roll it out in the organization, and all of a sudden we haven't listened to the viewpoints that were different, and we get to hear from people who think maybe we haven't gone about this in the right way. You know what? Our team would have really benefited from doing that earlier in the process, rather than later. Adapting your style. I'm not going to lie. I speak differently when I present it now than I do when I present it in my firm. The audience here, where you all have a really high EQ compared to maybe the IP lawyers that I work with on a regular basis, I can speak differently. I can adapt my style. I need to do the same when I'm leading different people in my teams. And then letting go and letting other people lead the way that works the best for them. So if their cognitive style tends to be more detailed, data analysis, use that, leverage that on your teams rather than asking people to focus on the things that you want to focus on. Give them space to focus on theirs. And then giving visibility to underrepresented perspectives, the HBR article gives some great examples about in team meetings, specifically calling out, hey, Mary, you're really detail oriented. Could you give me your perspective on this? So one thing you can easily start doing next week, if there's someone on your team who doesn't speak up a lot in meetings, it might be because their style, their perspective is really different than the rest of the team, and they might be nervous to do that. So coach them, encourage them, share your perspective. We need it. It might be different. That's great. That's what we need. And we have to help our lawyers learn to do this too. Because I believe that once you get into it and you start trying these practices, if you don't give up, you and your team will start doing happy dances rather than the angry pulling your hair out. And when you leave meetings, you go, gosh, I am so glad we took that extra 15 minutes to consider the perspective we might not have, because we would have missed that huge thing. So in closing, I'm going to thank Google Images because I stole all of it from there. the HBR article, because I stole all of it from there, and then my teams, because I have learned to be a better leader because I've made mistakes when I've worked with all of you, so thank you for that, and to NELP for offering this NELP Next opportunity. I believe we have amazing diversity in NELP. We have gender diversity, we have LGBT diversity, we have racial and ethnic diversity. I could go on and on. And we clearly have cognitive diversity. I've had the privilege of being on the board for the last year, and I see many of my board colleagues. And one of the amazing things about that experience is that we really bring back all kinds of diversity, but cognitive diversity for sure. And Mina, our outgoing president, has done an amazing job of using tools to make sure that our perspectives come together in those meetings. And NELP is really focused on making sure our future in this profession is going to be strong and solid, and that we as professionals can offer that to the legal profession. So thank you to NELP.
Thank you so much for being at the inaugural NELP Next session. I hope all of you will participate in future years if this is a program that continues. And thanks to our fabulous presenters for taking us on this voyage. They said it was just a tad more stressful than being on a panel. So we really appreciate it. And to Mina, thank you very much for your brainchild. It was really fun. So great. Nice to see you all.